Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. So much news to talk about on the election front and elsewhere. Today we have two debates on ballot measures. Proposition 15, which would split residential and commercial property in California for how they're treated for property taxes. We'll debate that coming up later this hour. And then Measure J in Los Angeles County, which was put on the ballot by the LA County supervisors. We'll debate that next hour. It calls for 10% of unrestricted county revenue to be used for a variety of different community programs that would not be for law enforcement or for incarceration. So we'll debate that Measure J coming up next hour. But we begin with President Trump and what he'd said was his hope that he'd be discharged from Walter Reed Military Hospital today, where he's being treated for COVID-19. Yesterday, the president briefly ventured out for a car ride around cheering supporters, an outing that disregarded precautions that are meant to contain COVID-19. The scale of the outbreak within the White House still being uncovered this morning. Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, as you just heard, announced she is positive for COVID-19, though asymptomatic at this point. She said that she will work from home and quarantine herself after the positive test. We don't know what comes next for President Trump, whether it's possible he will be released today or be kept additional days at Walter Reed. Joining us for the latest is Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor for Politica. Anita, good to have you with us. What's the latest on our understanding of COVID-19's intrusion into the White House and the Trump administration?
Well, it keeps changing, as you just indicated. You know, there are a lot of reporters and staffers and campaign officials at the Trump campaign that are getting tested just to see, you know, how far this will go in terms of, you know, you can get a test and then it'll be negative, as the press secretary said, and she was negative for several days and then she tested positive this morning. So there are a lot of people in the president's orbit that are getting tested and will continue to get tested this week. So we're expecting probably some more infections, but we just don't know that. In terms of the president, they still hope that he can come home today, but have still not given the official word publicly. So there are some there possibly will be a briefing here at Walter Reed Hospital in the next few hours to get the latest update on the president's health.
And we'll be carrying that for you live if that happens during Air Talk. We will have that briefing on the president's condition. Anita, one of the concerns has been over the past 3 days that there have been conflicting accounts of, first, you know, whether the president received oxygen or not, about the therapies that he was receiving, contrasting that with the way that his illness was being portrayed. At this point, has his medical team responded to that criticism that there doesn't seem to be clarity on the real state of the president's health?
Well, you know, they've sort of downplayed it. I would agree with you exactly on what you just said, but they've downplayed it. And one of the president's doctors yesterday had said, well, he was trying to provide an upbeat assessment just for the public and for the president, which, of course, you know, a lot of people responded and said, well, you're not supposed to provide upbeat. We just, you know, want the facts and the information. So, you know, the White House is really downplaying this and saying, look, they put this information out there. They've made the doctors, you know, come out for a briefing a couple days in a row, and they have presented some information. You know, there are people saying, look, they're not answering all the questions, and exactly what you said, which is some of it's contradictory. And so to that, they basically say, well, it wasn't looking very good. He's improved a lot. Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, said today that he has improved greatly, and they do expect, but haven't gotten the final word, that he should leave there for the White House later today.
We're talking with Anita Kumar of Politico. She's White House correspondent and associate editor. Anita, what is the potential for delay in the Supreme Court justice confirmation hearings, which are scheduled to start a week from today in the Senate Judiciary Committee? We have at least three senators who've announced that they're COVID-19 positive. So what effect does that have on this?
Well, it's a little bit unclear. I will tell you the Senate Republicans, and obviously the Republicans run that chamber, are saying that there will be no delay. And the reason is, as you said, the committee hearings will start, but they've had in the past, they've allowed these committee hearings to be both a little bit virtual and in person, so a hybrid. So if an infected senator wants to still participate or plans to participate, they can do that remotely. So not everybody has to be in the room. So they are planning on starting the hearings. Some will may not be there, but they intend to participate. Now, it comes now really more to the voting time. What will happen at the time that they're expected to vote? Will those senators be able to be present, both at the committee level and then when it goes to the floor? And that's a little bit unclear, both because we don't know about the quarantine and the situation with these three senators exactly, though they all say they plan to come back in time for the voting. And we also are waiting for other senators to be tested. There have been other senators around these senators that have been around the president or other people that have been impacted or that are now testing positive. So, you know, it's possible this week we'll see other infections.
We're talking with Anita Kumar of Politico. We have Wednesday night's vice presidential candidates debate that's scheduled in Salt Lake City. Is that scheduled to go on under the same protocols as had been intended from the beginning?
Yeah, it really is under the same protocols. But if you'll recall last week, some of the precautions that were supposed to be taken that were announced weren't actually taken. So I'll recall that in the actual debate room, people were supposed to wear face masks at all times, and they weren't doing that. So what I'm hearing is that organizers are going to be more strict about that. They're not going to allow people not to wear face masks. Also hearing that cloth masks are not going to be acceptable. They want people to wear these blue surgical masks that you've seen. They'll be available on site. So, you know, and of course, everybody is supposed to be tested. That's going to be in that debate room. And around that facility, they have to test within 72 hours of the debate.
And finally, Anita, NBC News, Wall Street Journal poll came out. The polling occurring right after the first of the three presidential debates, but before President Trump had tested positive for COVID-19. And it showed the president's support declining, a 14 percentage point gap now between Joe Biden leading in the race and President Trump. Now, it's a national poll. And of course, the election is decided on a state by state basis. Nonetheless, with the president at least appearing initially to suffer damage from the first debate, has there been any talk from within the White House about foregoing the next two debates?
No, I think that what will happen with those next two presidential debates will really depend on what the president's situation is with his health. There are people that are saying that he would not want to do something like, for example, a virtual debate, something that's not in person and in the room. But they do really want him to change his strategy. You know, the president actually thought that he did well, but there are a lot of people, Republicans and some of his allies, who said, no, you didn't let, Vice President Biden talk. And that was really the initial strategy. They wanted him to talk a lot and answer questions to try to get him to have a gaffe or a mistake. And they thought that would be the way to go. But as you remember, President Trump did a lot of the talking and the interrupting. So it was hard for Vice President Biden to get something out there, let alone get a mistake. So they really want him to change his tack, but they plan to go ahead and do this if the president is able. And I think that's really a big if. I mean, you know, we're coming up on the next one pretty soon here, and it's just really unclear whether the president will be physically able to do that trip. Will he be able to be around people? That's really unclear.
Anita, thank you so much. I know how busy you are and really appreciate your taking this time to bring us up to date on what's happening within the White House.
Okay, thank you.
Anita Kumar, Politico, White House correspondent and associate editor of Politico. Also with us, our frequent Air Talk guest, medical expert Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist and professor of medicine at UC San Francisco Medical Center. Dr. Chin Hong, always a pleasure. Seems like every article I was looking at over the weekend talking about the president's treatment, I see you quoted in it. So you've been a busy man this weekend.
I was so busy, Larry. But it's good to come back to my favorite group.
I appreciate it. We appreciate it. So let's, I want to ask you first about the treatment that has been described for the president, dexamethasone, the monoclonal antibody treatment, because we've been led to believe that those are for use in more serious COVID-19 cases. But in the case of the president, because of the importance of his position, could it be that they are giving him these treatments that typically would be held for a more serious case because he's the president?
Yes, Larry. I mean, I think there are a lot of inconsistencies and gaps in his treatment plan that I think myself and many of my colleagues around the country were, you know, frankly, flummoxed about why certain things were chosen, why they were chosen in that sequence. So let's break it down now. So as you recall, there are two phases in COVID. There is the infectious phase when the virus is just reproducing, and that's early on and making more virus progeny or children, so to speak. And then the body gets super angry and responsive by trying to kill the virus. So that's creating all this inflammation. And that's the second phase, which is actually more dangerous, and that's the inflammatory phase. So in the first phase, which is infectious, you want to stun the virus at all times, and that's by using things like convalescent plasma or antibodies, which the president got, except that he got engineered antibody, which is Regeneron, and probably wouldn't be available to you or I, Larry, if you were hospitalized outside of a trial. But he got it through an individual, what we call IND from the US FDA, so he was able to use it. The second treatment he got, remdesivir, we've talked about before, which is the antiviral made by Gilead. And again, it's for the first phase where you're just trying to keep the virus in check. And that's reasonable if people need oxygen. That's kind of the most commonly used drug right now in the United States for early COVID or people on who require oxygen, which gets to the key point and really the key issue is whether or not the president needed oxygen, which seemed to be so hard to get the answer from the doctors over the weekend. Finally, we found out that he was on intermittent oxygen, which still doesn't really lead us to feel good about the use of steroids. We know that from studies that the best bang for the buck in steroids is when you need not just a little oxygen, but a ton of oxygen, because it's really for the second phase, which is the inflammatory phase. So there are two possibilities. Either one, they're not giving us all the information, which is possible, about how really sick the president is. Or number two, the president has what we call VIP syndrome, where you know we treat people because of who they are and what they want rather than using rational medical evidence-based judgment.
And is that I mean, you're in San Francisco, where you have a lot of VIPs who come to UCSF Medical Center. And is that something that you have to deal with fairly regularly and your colleagues there, where you've got a very high-profile patient who says, you know, I want this cutting-edge thing, I want that. And the symptoms may not necessarily call for that, but, you know, because of the importance of the position or the responsibilities the person has, maybe you are more aggressive in the treatment than you would be otherwise.
Oh, certainly we feel that psychological pressure all the time whenever somebody famous comes in, either somebody prominent in entertainment or sports or somebody who's one of our faculty colleagues. And it may not be overtly explicit, but you always kind of put your antennae up. And I think what happens is that you probably treat them a little bit differently. I think the vast majority of quote-unquote VIPs who come in don't direct their care. They kind of relinquish that to us to really do our clinical, to have our clinical judgment. And I think if there was you know, rambunctious VIP, I think it would be a very difficult situation. And, you know, we've had that from time to time, but I would say at the end of the day, you know, we'd meet together as a group and not really do something if it were against medical judgment, particularly if it's dangerous. If you give steroids too early, it can cause infections. You're dampening the immune system when in the early part of disease, you want it to work a little bit more. It can cause mania. So one would wonder whether or not the president was feeling so high that he jumped into his car, broke all infection control procedures, running around, spreading viruses through his cloth mask. So I think, you know, these are all inconsistencies in the weekend.
With dexamethasone and remdesivir and the Regeneron product, what are the potential side effects, the downside of using those treatments if they were not necessary?
Well, I think the Regeneron is pretty safe. I mean, we have some good data around it. It's like convalescent plasma in that it doesn't really cause much side effects. So I think it's reasonable. Again, he got kind of like the Tesla of antibodies through a lab. Remdesivir, we usually would not discharge people on remdesivir because we need to monitor their kidney function, their liver function while they're on it because it can cause perturbations in those organs. And then the steroids, that's probably the one with the most risk-benefit calculus that you have to think about. You give it when you're not supposed to give it. You can feel, you know, it's not surprising if you feel good when you start taking steroids. Everyone does. But then after a while, your disease process catches up with you. So it's, you know, it can cause infections. It can cause people to feel their mental health issues, like feeling manic sometimes, high on steroids. So I think, you know, with every intervention, there is always a risk benefit. And then you have to think about drug interactions. The more drugs you give, you're probably bringing up potential drug interactions that you don't really know about. So the president's also taking zinc and vitamin D and famotidine. And I know a lot of people on social media have been pressing the president to take hydroxychloroquine. When are we going to be done with the hydroxychloroquine debate, you know?
Dr. Peter Chin Hong, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for walking through the medical treatment, at least as we understand it, knowing there are multiple questions. President Trump, thank you so much, sir.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Always a pleasure with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, UC San Francisco Medical Center infectious disease specialist and professor at UCSF. Coming up, we'll talk with Syracuse University historian and political scientist Margaret Susan Thompson, who's going to talk with us about the history of presidential illnesses and conditions and what was so often kept from the public. We'll continue in 1 minute on Air Talk. In just a few minutes, we'll debate Proposition 15, which would significantly change Proposition 13, passed in California back in 1978. We'll talk about that, the so-called split roll for property taxes, that coming up in a few minutes. But right now, we continue with our coverage of the hospitalization of President Trump. With us, Syracuse University Associate Professor of History and Political Science, Margaret Susan Thompson. Professor, thank you for being with us.
It's good to be with you.
There's a lot of skepticism, I think, when a president is ill and being treated because of historic precedent for trying to put the very best face on what could be a serious situation with the general public. I think, for example, when President Reagan was shot outside the Hilton Hotel in Washington, D.C., and at the time, we simply did not know the severity how much blood he lost and how close to death President Reagan came in that incident. Is that part of a pattern of public information about presidents in crisis?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, it's not just President Reagan. President Kennedy, we've learned since his death, had a very, very severe case of Addison's disease and was on a number of drugs that we didn't know about. The state of his health was quite precarious, actually. Similarly, when Franklin Roosevelt was reelected to his fourth term, he was in very serious ill health with cardiac problems and so on. and, of course, only lived for 3 months after his fourth inauguration.
And are there examples of comparative transparency when presidents have been facing a physical challenge where they've been open about it?
Ironically, the most transparent case we know of, I think, is after the shooting of President James A. Garfield. If you look at the news reports, which went on for months after he was shot, before he died, the newspapers at the time were filled with very detailed, often very gory, details about the state of his health and the infections and so on. And people waited every day for news to come by telegraph.
So at that point, why do you suspect that the print media of the day didn't feel the need to sort of cover that up, where in the case of FDR and his physical challenges, you know, media was very careful not to disclose that?
I think there's always been a kind of polite agreement between the press and the presidents, especially in modern times. We see it, for example, with President Kennedy. There was a kind of agreement in his case and in Franklin Roosevelt's case not to report on their sexual dalliances, for example. It took years after the death of FDR for people to know that he died in the presence of his mistress and not his wife. So I think that's part of the problem. In the 19th century, the print media was very, very competitive, and I think getting the most news was more important than trying to protect the president's privacy.
We're talking with historian and political scientist at Syracuse University, Professor Margaret Susan Thompson is with us. If you have questions for her about how presidents facing a physical crisis have dealt with that and how media has covered it, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. That's 866-893-5722. How would you compare this sort of protective layer around a president now with what it was like, you know, back when Kennedy was going through his chronic pain or FDR was dealing with his physical illness and paralysis? Is it similar or has it changed?
Well, I think what has changed is we have access to a lot more information. For example, you just had a very distinguished medical authority on the air. We don't just rely on the official reports the way I think was more likely to be the case in the past. But let's not forget that President Trump has not been terribly transparent about his health since he was a candidate for the White House. We've learned that he wrote the initial report of his health during the campaign in 2016. We have not received detailed reports of his annual physicals during his time in the White House. So there's been a lot of uncertainty, and I think that's led, unfortunately, to a lot of suspicion as to whether we're being told the truth or the whole truth.
Well, and as we were talking earlier, what seemed to be contradictory messaging between the course of treatment and what's described as the state of the illness with the president. So that, too, would naturally fuel that. And I don't know if there's any precedent for that, Professor.
Well, you know, I'm not a doctor, and I can't evaluate that. What we do know, for example, is that in the case of President Kennedy, as I said, and Robert Dallek in his biography of JFK has documented this extensively, was on a variety of medications that were potentially interactive and dangerous. We certainly didn't know that at the time, and there was a lot of emphasis placed during his lifetime on the physical vigor of President Kennedy, for example, when that was really not the case.
John in Long Beach says, I'm a retired history teacher. Back when Garfield was shot, the press was particularly lurid and a lot of unethical journalism. So those reports might not have even been accurate. The lurid ones, graphic ones that you were talking about, Professor Thompson?
Some of them certainly certainly weren't, but a lot of them surprisingly were. I mean, there were doctors standing outside the room. Remember, we didn't have the same level of security around the president as we do today. So while it's true that some of it may not have been as accurate as we would have liked, that really hasn't changed, has it?
Hey, John writes on the page, Reagan's cancer surgery in 1985 is an excellent example of transparency and clarity. His team made sure the public had accurate information because they experienced the debacle of chaotic information when Reagan was shot in 81. Professor Thompson, you recall the 85 cancer surgery?
That's true, although even then there was some downplaying the seriousness of this. Although his cancer was not, as it turns out, life-threatening, thank goodness, it's always serious, and we were getting reports from Don Regan and others rather than from medical experts sometimes.
Professor, so good to talk with you. Thank you for sharing your expertise.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Syracuse University Associate Professor of History and Political Science, Margaret Susan Thompson, with us on Air Talk. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, and as we're doing almost daily on our program, we're bringing you the very latest on the ballot proposition to help prepare you to cast your vote.